Thank you and welcome, everyone. This is Mike Adams interviewing J.R. Nyquist for the second time. Now, J.R. Nyquist at jrnyquist.blog, that's his website. He's got some fantastic articles. He is the top guy in geopolitical analysis of Russia, especially, and its interaction with the United States, long-term goals, strategic initiatives of Russia, but also, to some extent, China and China's desire to really occupy and take over the United States, to destroy the American people, and to achieve world domination. Now, he joins us again today. The last interview we did with Jeff is a couple of weeks ago. It was very popular, very widely reviewed. People were freaked out by it, I gotta say, though. People were, I guess, scared because they hadn't really seen the dynamics of what was happening. And I gotta tell you, we're not here to scare you. We are here to tell you what's really happening so that we can avoid the negative outcomes and hopefully achieve, well, let's say avoid World War III for sure, but achieve some measure of peace and prosperity as we move forward human civilization. I mean, that's the real goal here. So Jeffrey Nyquist, or J.R. Nyquist as he's known, joins us today. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us again. I really value your voice and opinions. It's great to have you back on.
Thanks for having me.
So opening question, and then I'll let you do more of the talking. But right now, of course, the United States is very vulnerable due to the what I believe is the Chinese engineered Wuhan coronavirus biological weapon system that I believe was deliberately released. You can answer that yourself. And now America is economically vulnerable. It's culturally vulnerable. People are angry, taking to the streets. Looks like there's going to be some social unrest, maybe warning signs of civil war, perhaps, down the road. I'm not sure. There's political unrest. Wouldn't this be the time for China to strike America as we appear to be at our weakest? Is that something China is considering, in your opinion?
Well, if you look at the strategic literature, the way it's framed, you go to people like page 100 of Jan Shaina's book, We Will Bury You, and he talks about the long-range strategy. It's always been about creating severe economic problems for the United States, dislocating the economy, turning the people against the government, causing a civil war or a revolution in the U.S., and in combination with using the forces of the communist bloc to take over countries and to defeat the United States in a major war. These things are all conceived of as a combination play. And combination is a chess term where you have certain pieces focused in a way that they work together in a combination. This same idea applies in military strategy, in grand strategy, for the way the Russians and communists think. They think not only in terms of military forces, but cultural forces, infiltration of the government, the creation of intellectual narratives that we buy into that are completely disorienting to us. And the problem that we've had over the last 30, 40 years is that we've had a series of narratives that part or all of our people have bought into. The narrative that communism was defeated, that the Cold War ended, that Russia became a democracy, that China is capitalist. None of these narratives are true. And yet they have been so hammered into our heads that when I come on, and the documentation is massive on this, when I come on and I quote facts and I talk about what defectors and other experts have said, people look at me like, what, did you come down from outer space? You know, what planet are you on? The thing is that the problem is that people do not read. You know, I had a military guy tell me this past week that the problem with people high up in the government in the military is they don't read. They get their idea of reality from headlines and from, you know, small little sentences appearing on the TV news, and they think that's the truth. And the problem is we've been misinformed by the news, fake news, for decades. It isn't just something that's recently happened.
So I agree with what you're saying, absolutely. And most Americans live in a very narrow bubble of false reality. It basically, it's their Twitter feed. It's the celebrity videos on YouTube. And yeah, it's all disinformation, and it's frankly quite pathetic and very, very narrow. They don't have an expansive view of what's happening in the world. But the effectiveness of that propaganda effort to really dumb down the people, it seems like the long-term goal of that is to make sure that America has no readiness when the attack comes. Is that a correct assessment?
Yes, no readiness. And part of readiness is orientation, intellectual and mental orientation. We are not even oriented towards our enemy. All you see from the right and the left, you know, the left will have you believe the enemy is the CIA and the U.S. government. The right will have you believe that it's some kind of Jewish banking cartel. Nobody's looking at Moscow and Beijing, that actual communist bloc that never really went away, that has played all kinds of disinformation games with us. And look, if people say it's the Illuminati, how many nuclear weapons do they have again? There's Russia, there's China. These are big, the biggest country in the world, Russia, in land area, and the biggest country in the world in population, with all their satellites and manipulated countries. And we've got people who have background in communist parties, like Angela Merkel in Germany. We had Barack Obama as president. He was mentored by a Communist Party member, Frank Marshall Davis, when he was a teenager. I mean, we have a serious problem of, we don't even understand who our own politicians are, how we've been infiltrated. And my whole focus, since I discovered that there were communists, when they tried to recruit me when I was in college, and I said, oh my gosh, these people are real. And I got interested in it. And I found out, this is when Reagan was president, I found out, wait a minute, there's a whole thing going on here and nobody's paying attention to it. And of course, the problem is that we do live in this beautiful country, this capitalist shopping mall regime, everything's so wonderful. But if we intellectually, if we don't keep up our knowledge, we can't not only maintain this way of life, we can't even defend it. And the thing people have to understand is how misinformed they are. They have no clue. So when I talk to people, they're like, that can't be true. And now when people are waking up and seeing we're under attack, we're in the early phases of World War III. This is the preparatory period. There's no doubt in my mind that's what this is.
I completely agree with you. I want to ask your views on the virus. I've called it a Pearl Harbor, or a biological Pearl Harbor attack on America. And it is, in my view, it's achieving what Communist China would have as the desired outcome. I mean, think about all the things that it is achieving, not just economic destruction and, you know, public health problems, but also the social chaos, the political chaos, the mistrust of between factions all across America. It is ripping this country apart right now. Do you think it was intentional?
Oh, yeah. Well, the evidence that it was intentional, I mean, I think we talked about this before, but when you look at how they incubated it in Wuhan, and they used that potluck in Wuhan where the Communist Party higher officials prohibited the mayor of Wuhan and the local party officials from stopping the potluck. It's the potluck where they think 10,000 people were infected. And then they basically stopped the train traffic going out of Wuhan, but they allowed the international air traffic out of Wuhan. So this thing would go all over the world. Now, you tell me that's not conscious planning. This was planned. And when it comes out of the virology lab, there's a very nuanced way to look at this. If there's two interesting factors here. If they were going to say that we attack them, it would be Wuhan. Because Wuhan is the hub of China. If somebody was going to attack China, they would attack at Wuhan. So why did they place their virology lab there? Because they needed two alibis, one for their own people and one for us. The alibi they give to us is, oh, it escaped from the plant by accident. The alibi they give to their people is the Americans attacked us. The only way both of those alibis work is if they put their level 4 virology lab in Wuhan. Now you tell me, what other country in the world has placed their level 4 lab in the hub of their country?
Yeah, the economic hub, the industrial hub.
The industrial, this is where the two major rivers come together. This is where the rail lines come together. This is in the geographically the center of China's population mass. So this is very strange.
And let's shift to the economic impact of this. I'm aware that China has been purchasing a lot of physical gold over the years, thousands of tons of gold, while, of course, a lot of people are questioning whether Fort Knox and so-called, you know, U.S. gold or Western gold even exists at all, or how much exists. Because
I believe that now officially the factors on gold are the Chinese are supposed to have 1.8 kilotons. We're supposed to have 8. The Russians are supposed to have 2. But the problem is that the secretiveness of the Chinese, they have been accumulating. You could go back to news articles to 1997, 1998, and find that they were buying gold from Australia back then. They were buying, they have been buying gold for a long time. And the idea of how much they actually have, I mean, there was a time where people were not believing in gold. Financial entities, you had European countries selling off their gold. We don't know exactly how much they've got, but it's something that countries do in preparing for war, because in war, it's hard currency that matters. Currencies can collapse in a war, especially a war of mass destruction. And let's talk for a second about the virus as a part of an economic attack. Very important thing has happened. We've got tankers, oil tankers, stacked up here off of California. The price of oil has gone negative. United States, Saudi Arabia, and Russia are the big oil producers right now, the three big oil producing countries in terms of actual output. And you had earlier in the month of April, you had this deal where when the demand, when you know we basically went into this lockdown situation in the West, demand for oil fell off rapidly. And when the OPEC Plus meeting happened, the Russians said, oh, we're not going to lower our production, when the Saudis proposed everybody lower their production. So the Saudis got mad, increased their production, 10 million barrels. Now imagine, global oil production is falling and the Saudis increased their oil production. And the Saudis claim they're doing it because they're mad at the Russians and that they want to hurt the Russians. But the Russians have a lot of flexibility, and Russia is not a capitalist economy in the sense that the U.S. is. What this really did is the United States has oil industry depends on fracking and processes that oil has to be over $40 to $45 a barrel. It's destroying our oil industry. Russia has the wherewithal to hunker down. Russia does not, by the way, Russia as a country has a very low a debt to GDP ratio. I think it's only like 17%. United States, we're talking, if we take all debt into account, we're talking in the 200s of percent of GDP. China is in the 300s because they have hidden the way their debt works. But this economic warfare benefits China, because China is not an oil producing country. It's an oil consuming country. China is getting its oil for free. It can stockpile, buy up as much as it wants. The demand, by the way, for oil in China has not slacked off like it has in the West. This indicates that China is not doing the same kind of economic thing that we are. Their economy, their arms industries, they're still churning. Ours, everything is in this lockdown situation. And now this huge economic hit to our oil industry and to other of our industries. And this is an attack. And the significance here is that Saudi Arabia and Russia, a lot of people are beginning to realize they're working together on this, that the Saudis have been angry that we've developed our own oil independence, our own energy independence with this fracking. And that some years ago, they tried to a sort of mini attack on the fracking, tried to pull the oil prices down below the level that our fracking could be productive. But this is really their big chance. And this shows that the Saudis have really stabbed us in the back and are working with the Russians. And this is very dangerous, because it means the Saudis now aren't, now they're lying and saying, oh no, we're not trying to do it to hurt America. They've turned over to Russia and China. Russia and China can guarantee their security against Iran now better than we can, because they're the ones that hold the cards over Iran.
Well, it seems like, from everything you just said, that this would be the ideal moment for China to unleash an attack on our currency.
Yes.
with our currency, the trillions of dollars in bailout money, the Federal Reserve taking on a massive amount of well, they call them assets. You know, basically the Fed buying up everything with fake money. The Fed balance sheet is headed toward $10 trillion, and it will probably end up at $20 trillion by the time we're through with this. I mean, can you imagine? And the federal, the deficit of our government could be $25 trillion in less than a year, which is insane. I mean, isn't this just begging for a currency attack?
Well, yeah, and of course, this is why flipping Saudi Arabia is so important in a currency attack, because basically, one of the major ways that we maintain our currency, because it's not gold-backed, is that we are the defender of the free world. We defend Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, which is protecting Japan and Europe's oil supply, because they're the ones that use this Middle East oil much more than we rely on it. And it's called exporting our inflation.
Yes.
Oil trading is done in dollars. They need these dollars to keep doing these trades. So basically, you know, normally if we had to absorb all our own inflation, that would be bad. But we can actually generate dollars digitally, or we can print them, and they're absorbed by all these other countries, by the rest of the world economy. They absorb it. And it's like a tax that the United States levies on all the countries in the world. And one of the advisors, former advisors to an Australian prime minister, my best friend is friends with him, and he asked him about this, and he said, even people on the left in Australia, although they might complain about the United States, they want the United States to export its inflation because they're glad to pay that cost for America to defend them, because Australia can't effectively defend itself against China, against perhaps even Indonesia. So Australia really needs the U.S. aircraft carrier battle fleets and the U.S. nuclear umbrella, and the same thing for the countries of Europe. And Saudi Arabia, of course, look to us to defend us from Iran. Now, if pressure is applied to those countries, especially the oil ones, and Saudi Arabia is a kingpin, to flip and go over to Russia and China, then Russia and China can change the way oil trading is done, get the dollar out of it, stop us from being able to export our inflation. Now we have to absorb the hit ourselves. This is where it becomes dangerous for the dollar.
Yeah, that means the Fed would have to print money to buy U.S. debt, and then we're in a hyperinflation debt spiral.
Then, right. And you tack up inflation. Inflation, basically, basic economics is inflation destroys an economy because it causes bubbles and it causes problems with investment. You get a lot of malinvestment the more inflation you get, and then you end up with a crack-up boom in which you have deflation. Catastrophic deflation. And actually, deflation is the healing period. When you have deflation, you're correcting the problems caused by bubbles and inflation. But you have this pain of unemployment, and you have this pain of job losses and industries lost. And the fact is, economies have to go through this. And I think we are facing this. We're going to have to face up to this, because in a large degree, our economy has, as far as it's connected to China, and it's been very concerned with a certain kind of consumption. We have malinvested. We've invested in the wrong things because we have thought China is a partner, not an enemy. We thought of Russia as a partner, not an enemy. When we wake up to realize this, we needed to invest more in defense, less in consumer goods. We needed a different kind of arrangement, and we didn't need to be with China all over our business, in terms of banking, money, investment, and in our labs, in our science, making our pharmaceuticals, making our vitamins. This has major implications for biological warfare, by the way. And the fact that we have not been vigilant against communism, that we've not understood that China is a communist country, they used that against us to get into these positions to harm us, and that's what they're doing now. They're harming us.
Well, this was the whole promise of globalism has now collapsed due to the coronavirus. I mean, look, Richard Nixon, he, of course, stopped recognizing Taiwan and put the national recognition onto China as the rightful owner of all of China, including Taiwan, by the way. And since then, of course, we've exported our industries to China. China has stolen intellectual property from us in a way that many U.S. presidents have openly allowed. frankly, until Trump. Every president allowed theft of intellectual property, the exportation of factories and manufacturing know-how, to the point where China's making airplanes and automobiles and military equipment that, frankly, we spent the R&D dollars to develop. And at the same time, Taiwan isn't allowed to talk to the WHO because the communists are running the WHO too. Yeah. I mean, it's insane. And it is time to stop the communists from dominating everything in the world, including dominating the United States.
Yeah, yeah. And the other problem is that U.S. counterintelligence has been collapsed for a long time. And look, you know from Chiao Chen's speech, I think we've talked about General Chiao Chen's speech, he was the defense minister of China, and that sometime after 2000, before he retired as defense minister in 2003, he gave a speech talking about using biological war to destroy the United States. And I want to talk about this for a minute, about the weapon, and why it's very dangerous for people on the right to say that this is a hoax or that the virus is not dangerous. Look, I'm just going to say something. I have never read such unscientific garbage and such statistically illiterate material as I've read from well-meaning people on the right, largely libertarians, who want to defend the capitalist system, who want to deny that this virus is dangerous. All you have to do is look at the death figures for New York City. New York City, now its population has been declining. In the last 3 years, roughly about 150 people a day die in April and March in New York. We have had, you know, many times that number. I think it was 820 deaths here one day in New York City. Okay. How many times the normal death rate of 150 is that? You know, that's more than five times the normal death rate. And you're telling me that, well, if it's not coronavirus killing the people, then what is it? And it's like, I cannot believe these people come on and say, oh, they're claiming all these other deaths are caused by coronavirus and they're not. No, you don't understand. Look at the raw death numbers in New York. They have maintained good statistics about day-to-day death figures in New York for years. You look at the death rate in New York in the last 5 weeks. Well, since the first death in New York, I think, was March 11th. You look at the death rate, and you cannot account for these deaths unless something.
Yeah, mortalities.
Right, the mortality rate. And so when people say this, wait a minute, you don't understand how dangerous. And by the way, the Chinese would not have disrupted their own economy, would not be locking people in their homes, would not be building extra hospitals, would not be doing what they're doing if this thing wasn't a killer.
Yes. Yeah.
They wouldn't be doing it.
I completely agree with you. I've spoken out about this. I've been criticized for it. But I have never seen such displays of mathematical illiteracy, basic science illiracy. Yeah. I've seen, and again, it's almost all pro-Trump conservative publishers, pro-liberty publishers, and pundits and so on, and they are saying that the regular flu has a 10 times higher death rate than the coronavirus. And I say, what? That's like saying 4 + 4 = 40,000.
Yeah.
You know, where are you even getting this? I mean, it doesn't even make sense.
They cannot account. In fact, the if anything, if we look at New York is the place we have the best numbers for. New York City, not the state. If we look at New York as a city, if we look at the number of deaths claimed for coronavirus, I think it was as of the 27th, they claimed 10,000. But when they looked at the total mortality rate, they realized that they have over 3,000 additional deaths unaccounted for, which means people are dying at home and they're not, it's not being counted. They're saying, yes. Well, they're elderly or whatever. She died of a heart attack. She died of this. She died in her sleep. Because people don't go to the hospital and they just die. They're elderly. They die in their sleep.
Right. And then the testing, of course, isn't done on corpses. So they're never accounted for.
Right.
And the Financial Times did an excellent story on this. I'm sure you saw it. They looked at excess mortalities in Madrid, across Germany and France, even Ecuador, many other countries, over a dozen countries, and also some cities around the world. And what they saw was that there's actually COVID-19 deaths are being undercounted by a wide margin. It's probably 50% higher than the official numbers.
Yeah, at least probably a third higher. And here's the interesting thing about there was an epidemiological study, and I read it. And I have the advantage, I was trained as a social scientist. So understanding numbers and doing analysis is what I was taught to do. And one of the interesting conclusions, which I don't know how good the numbers were, but it said that when you have that first death, you have approximately 80,000 people infected by that point. And you say, well, how can that be? You know, and this confuses Black people. It's because it takes a long time for people to start dying.
Right.
Because people can have this thing for 5 weeks and die from it and show no symptoms for up to more than three weeks. So by the time you have a death, this thing is spread around quite a bit. And if you use that, you know, one of the tricks that they've used to claim the virus isn't killing people is, well, you know, 20% of the people already have had the virus. Let's look at that. First death in New York on the 11th of March, if you have 80,000 people there and it's doubling, well, they're already having starting people are behaving, their behavior is changing. So let's say every 7 days you're doubling. Still, by the time you get to the lockdown where you're flattening the curve, you're not even getting very much past 300,000 people infected in the country. So I think the basic epidemiological science is generally, I mean, we know it. It's pretty much correct in attempting to politically massage these numbers. Look, as people who want to defend the country, we do have to get our economy moving, but we have to be honest about how to do it and that if people are going to die, you know, yes. We have to be honest about it.
Well, so many critical issues here. I'm glad you brought this up. I didn't even ask you about this, but, you know, people are conflating the infection fatality rate with the case fatality rate. You know, when you look at the regular flu and they say, well, 34,000 people died last year from the regular flu, and that's out of 35 million who were infected, they say, well, that's a 0.1% fatality rate or 1 out of 1,000. But that's not even true. It turns out the 35 million figure is the number of people who were diagnosed with the flu after becoming symptomatic. Those are the symptomatic people. So the case fatality rate is 0.1%. The infection fatality rate, you have to consider everybody who was infected with the flu and never showed any symptoms. That number is 140 million. So that means the actual fatality rate of those who were infected by the flu is only 1 in 4,000 people. And that's about 100 times lower than the infection fatality rate from the coronavirus, according to current numbers. So I've done the math on this quite extensively, by the way.
Yeah.
And based on all the math, and I'm very good at math. You know, I'm a scientist. I work every day in a lab. The coronavirus, the case fatality rate of the coronavirus, the CFR, is 100 times higher than the CFR of the regular flu, 100 times higher. And yet you have conservative media claiming it's 10 times lower. So between the two of us, there are three orders of magnitude of disagreement.
Yeah.
But I tell you, they're wrong because they can't do math.
Yeah, no, they can't. I'm very disappointed. And it's a lack of scientific education. And the other thing I'm really disturbed at is the number of doctors that have come on to make these claims. And I've read some of the papers and I'm just astonished that these people don't have analytical ability. They're not scientific. They don't understand. Look, in science, it's very hard to prove things. And this is, let's get into this about the virus and about a biological weapon and the disagreement over whether this thing is a weapon or not. You have the Indian paper. And I think you read the Indian paper that was withdrawn. And we know there's political reasons why these things are withdrawn. And we look at the protein sequencing and we look at the RNA sequencing. This is an RNA virus. There's some serious problems here for claiming this is natural. And you've got a number of scientists that have come out to say, hey, this is not natural. But yet the CIA comes out and says this past week, oh, it's a natural occurring virus.
Of course they did.
This is the same CIA that was trying to make Trump look like he was a Russian puppet, you know.
Right.
So, but the real important thing here is in analyzing this whole thing is to remember that it is a weapon, that it was released intentionally. The Chinese know much more about this than they do. And if you look, I've been reading a lot on virology. I've been reading Charles Ortlieb's books, his one about Fauci, which is very interesting, and this testimony of Judy Mikovits, who was put in jail by Fauci and had a very interesting case. Look, there's a lot of journalists and there's a lot of research. There's a huge body of testimony that Fauci is dirty, that he has committed criminal acts, acts of criminal fraud, intellectual theft, abuse of power. There's something wrong with Fauci. Now, what really troubles me about this as an analyst is that if you have a corrupt bureaucracy, the National Institutes of Health, the CDC, and you got powers like Russia and China that are looking to do a biological attack on America, where are they? How does China and Russia get their agents in to an American agency? The back door is always corruption. You're looking at, what has Fauci been in his position at the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Disease for like 37 years? And according to Mikovits, she got in there, he got in there by intellectual theft. Him and Mr. Gallo stealing her and her boss, Frank Rossetti's research. So if that's true, you have a guy that got his position by fraud, that is vulnerable to blackmail, that is operating like a gangster within the National Institutes of Health and the CDC. And you've got a foreign powers here with very, very good infiltrators, double agents, bribery, blackmail. If this guy cares about fame and fortune, look, a KGB officer once told me, I knew a KGB officer who at the end of the Cold War was tasked with going around all the NATO jails, visiting all the spies that NATO caught in Europe. And I asked him, I said, Victor, what were these people like? And he said, oh, they were all egomaniacs. They all wanted to be, you know, powerful and important.
Being celebrated on a Saturday Night Live, like Dr. Fauci was recently?
That's exactly right. Yep. And this is one of the things the journalists have said about Fauci, is that Fauci wanted to be on The Tonight Show back in the 80s. He wanted to be on with Johnny Carson. He was a person who wanted this fame and fortune. And this is the psychological profile of someone who's recruitable as a spy, as an influence agent, as a sabotage agent by the communist bloc. So there needs to be a counterintelligence investigation of Mr. Fauci. Now, I'm not saying Fauci is a Soviet or Chinese spy, but I'm saying that there's so much testimony about corruption. For the defense of a country in a biological war, his position is decisive. He has to be completely honest and credible. And if he's not, we have a problem with our defense as a country.
We already know that Fauci oversaw the funneling of money to the Wuhan lab, the Virology Institute lab.
Well, there you go.
Even mainstream media Newsweek has done a shocking piece exposing Dr. Fauci's what looks like likely financial ties and so on during the Obama administration in particular. I consider Dr. Fauci to be the Robert Mueller of biology. You know, Robert Mueller is totally corrupted, completely dishonest, you know, compromised from day one. Dr. Fauci seems to be the same thing to me. And the fact that he's being celebrated in the media, that's a red flag right there. The media doesn't celebrate someone typically unless they're doing a tremendous amount of evil these days.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I'm going to point out, Diana West wrote a book called The Red Thread, which I recommend everyone to get and read. And it's about the whole scandal surrounding attempting to make Trump out to being a Russian puppet, the whole Russiagate scandal. And she goes into the background of people like Mueller and James Comey, a lot of the principals, Nellie Orr and Bruce Orr's wife, of these people. And what she finds is they all have communism in their background.
That's right.
James Comey admitted that he was a communist in college. We have a former CIA director, John Prennan, admitted he voted for Gus Hall, the head of the Communist Party in 1976. We have, a lot of these connections. She goes into it. She has a whole book on it, The Red Thread. Nellie Orr is basically an apologist for Stalin as a historian who worked for the CIA. Why do we have Stalin apologists working at the CIA as experts on Russia? This is I don't think people understand how penetrated we've been. And when people talk about the deep state, look, the deep state is the communists, and the communists are the deep state. That in a nutshell. Yeah.
But America, you know, people have been waiting for 3+ years for Trump to do something. There's been rumors, I'm sure you've heard them, that there are 50,000 sealed indictments and there are going to be mass arrests of these communists who have infiltrated every level of government and so on. Okay, great. But, you know, even the sort of the trust the plan movement and so on, but week after week after week, we see no action on any of these fronts. Instead, what we see is just continued assaults, more weapons released, you know, this COVID-19. You know, Trump had the election in the bag, probably.
Yeah.
Now, I put his chances of being reelected at the moment at only 1 in 8. And part of that, I believe, is because we're going to have a second wave of infections because people refuse to wear masks because they refuse to take this thing seriously. So there's no question in my mind. I've even done the models. We're going to have a second wave by August here. I mean,
they've already had a second wave in Germany. You know, I mean, every time a country tries to back away from having some kind of look at China has even tightened up some of their restrictions. I think, but here's the interesting thing. Virology, I'm learning. I'm having to study it because the biological weapons back in the day that the Russians had, except for smallpox, it wasn't the most potent biological weapon back in the day during the so-called Cold War was anthrax, which is not a contagious illness. And it's done, they use what they call polar outbreak attack. They seed cold air masses in the Arctic with it, and that's how they infect people with it. But this idea of an infectious vector using viruses, look, if you look at the arguments, the scientific arguments, you go back to AIDS, for example, anti-immune deficiency syndrome. You talk about Peter Duisberg and Fauci and Gallo and Rossetti and all these people, the arguments about what was causing the diseases surrounding anti-immune deficiency syndrome, you realize that the science of virology is very controversial, filled with controversy, and proving things is very difficult. And what we had in the 1980s was you had a massive decline in integrity of science in the 1980s. In fact, I know about this because I became interested at the time when I was in graduate school, this was an issue. In fact, in 1989, U.S. Congress, there was so much fraud in science. The U.S. Congress was thinking about establishing a Department of Scientific Integrity to check up on the scientists. But the problem they had is if the scientists are that corrupt, how do they make sure that the Department of Scientific Integrity isn't corrupt?
Right, right. And it takes a scientist to look at the work of other scientists. You
right.
can't just have a bureaucrat look at the science. They don't know what they're looking at.
Look, my chairman of my political science department when I was in graduate school was Harry Eckstein, and he was sort of a disciple of Karl Popper. And you probably know this. Karl Popper was very good on epistemology and the philosophy of science. And as a political scientist, we were back then saying, you know, people were saying, oh, you're not a real science. You know, social science is a real science. The hard science is a real science. Well, what we really studied the philosophy of science when I was in graduate school. We studied Karl Popper. And what we discovered was these crazy people in the so-called hard sciences were doing everything wrong. They did not understand the principles of science, and they were going wrong in all kinds of places. Look at how messed up physics is. Yeah. Look at how messed up medicine is. You know this very well. Yeah. And here we were being really conscientious. We're going, wow, there's really good stuff being done in social science, and these other sciences are going astray. Why? Karl Popper pointed out that it's very hard to empirically prove something. Why is it hard to empirically prove something? Like, for example, HIV is a good example. Frank Rossetti believed that the mechanism of destroying T cells in the HIV, what is it, the Kaposi sarcoma, was actually an autoimmune attack on the T cells. That, you know, Peter Duisberg was an expert in retroviruses, and he said, "There's the retrovirus isn't active against the T cells. How's it happening?" Their theory was that it was the antibodies of the body itself attacking it. Well, that implies that viruses can cause autoimmune disease. Wow, if that's true. My gosh, what we don't know about autoimmune disease. You look at it right now. This is a cutting edge of science, as you know, autoimmune disease. What is causing it? Now, it's interesting that one of Rossetti's assistant, this Judy Mikovich, made the point that they believed that not just viruses could cause autoimmune disease and have your own immune system attack your body, but that toxins could do it, that the toxins could activate the virus, and that you have a combination play. Now I want to suggest to people about COVID-19, why there's some very strange deaths with COVID-19, with people with blood clotting. You probably read about this blood clotting thing.
Yeah.
About the story about the iron being knocked out of the red blood cells so they can't carry oxygen, like acting like a blood disease. It's possible that we're dealing with, you probably heard of binary chemical weapons. Where you have two completely harmless chemicals. One can be stored as a fertilizer, the other can be stored as some other kind of industrial chemical separately. You put it together, you got the deadliest nerve agent in the world, right? You put these things. The same thing can happen here. If what Frank Rossetti's research shows is right, you could have a combination of some toxin introduced maybe even in a vaccine, since, by the way, this was the claim that's made against Fauci and vaccines, is that these vaccines contain toxins. If you're introducing a toxin in a vaccine that interacts and basically activates viruses, you can turn the immune system into a weapon. You can have something acting against the blood. This is so arcane. It's so difficult. Scientists do not understand these things. And yet, maybe the Chinese and Russians have made some discoveries and they understand it. And maybe this weapon is part of some kind of combination attack. And we do not understand what that combination attack is as yet.
Well, I think it's very likely that that's the case. It's something that I've written about, that we've talked about before as well. And also see how aggressively the vaccine for coronavirus is being pushed, even when it doesn't exist yet in any kind of commercially available form. I mean, you talk about science fraud. The entire media is saying that the vaccine is going to save us. There hasn't been a clinical trial. There hasn't been any evidence, but it doesn't matter to them. I mean, these are the people who say, well, you can't talk about vitamin C. There's no evidence. But they say a vaccine will work when there's no evidence. And the level of fraud that's carried out by the government agencies, the EPA, the FDA, the CDC, and so on, is extraordinary. I mean, I've interviewed other scientists. One scientist ran a top lab for the EPA, found that if you take human sewage, bio sludge, and you spread it on farms, you release all kinds of toxins that are very toxic for the environment. So what did the EPA do to him? Shut him down, threatened him, sent armed law enforcement officers to his house to drag him out of his house at 3 a.m. and say, you don't talk about this. And then they shut him down, took all his grant money, kicked him out, and he was blackballed from the industry. That sounds a lot like what happened to Judy Mikovits, frankly. It's the same pattern, and they do it all across government agencies. Anytime a scientist begins to conduct real science or stumbles upon a real truth, they get killed or blacklisted or thrown in prison. That's what's happening.
Yeah, the National Institutes of Health is really, in the CDC, our first line of defense against a biological attack. It makes perfect, if I was the Chinese intelligence service or the Russian, I would infiltrate there.
Yeah.
So have they infiltrated there? Is that the explanation? Again, we need to have counterintelligence that is under patriotic American control, that's not been sabotaged. And we have to have an investigation of the National Institutes of Health and the CDC and of the Justice Department. This whole thing around Trump, this Trump-Russia right. thing, it stinks. And
but
by the way, yeah.
When all those agencies are infiltrated by communists.
Yes, absolutely. You go, look, I've done investigations, follow-up investigations of things the FBI has done on the West Coast. I was told by an inspector general of the Justice Department that there is serious problems at the FBI and at the Justice Department. This is in the late 90s. In the late 90s, of course, Clinton was president there. We have two basic presidents who were candidates to being stealth communist presidents. And people say, oh, Nyquist, you're crazy. Stealth communist president. Look, I was in communist meetings because they were trying to recruit me in the early 80s. And what were they talking about? Electing a stealth communist president.
Right.
Right.
And we ended up with Obama, who was clearly a sleeper cell against America.
And the Clintons. Look, the Clintons have a background of having been involved in communist front organizations in the late 1960s. Bill Clinton took a very mysterious trip in the winter of 1970 into the communist bloc by himself. Who takes a vacation by themselves to go to Moscow and Prague?
What do you mean? Without secret service? What do you mean?
What's that?
Without secret service protection?
No. When he was a Rhodes student. He was
long before. Okay.
Yeah, in 1969 he went to Moscow in December 1969, and then in January 1970 he went to Prague by himself on a trip. Now, who paid for the trip? A front organization that was controlled by the KGB. He was involved in an anti-war thing. And Hillary Clinton was also involved, very involved, with communists and communist front organizations. Yeah. This is all well documented. And so, yeah.
The release of this biological weapon then would be the ultimate victory for the communists to get rid of Trump, who is sort of the last defense of America, you know, a sense of national sovereignty, secure borders. Trump has made some efforts to try to get rid of communists in the system, but he's just overwhelmed by it. And now the virus is destroying the economy by design, out from underneath Trump. And sadly, as we've talked about, Trump's own supporters are spreading the virus, likely by not wearing masks. So they're making it worse. It's like, this is the worst of all possibilities here.
Right. The thing is that I believe in freedom. I believe in a free economy and so on. But when you're in a war, nobody wins a war by being everybody being free and doing what they want and going to the beach and shopping. You win a war, everybody pulls together, everybody tightens their belt, and everybody sacrifices, or you don't get through it. You don't survive. Sorry. Okay. I'm sorry. That's just the way it is.
Well, it's like in World War II, everybody bought war bonds and they gathered up all the scrap metal from their homes and barns, and they donated metal to the government so the government could have factories build battleships and bullets and things like that. I mean, it was a national sacrifice for years, not just 6 weeks where you're getting, you know, paid free bailout money to sit at home and play on your Xbox all day. That's not sacrifice. These Americans that think this is the end of the world, give me a break. You should check out what your grandparents or your great-grandparents fought for, you know? That was real sacrifice.
Yeah, every generation of Americans has become softer and softer and more neurotic as time's gone on. I'm sorry if this is not happy news for people, but look, it's not just the psychological softness. It's intellectually they've gone soft. You know, I've been at this for a long time thinking, you know, when I was first writing my books and doing my research, I thought, am I really right about this? Of course, now we see it is, I am right. But I was waiting for somebody to come up and say, and give me the respect of saying, you know, Jeff, you're wrong. And here's the sources you missed. And here's how your reasoning went wrong. Nobody in 33 years of me doing this, nobody has come along to correct me. Everybody has either personally attacked me, or they've given a non-facts and wrong information to debunk me. And that has always made me like, you mean I have to keep doing this? You mean I have to keep being an outcast and saying these things because nobody can disprove me? I mean, come on, give me a break. Show me that I'm wrong, for crying out loud.
No, I know exactly how you feel.
Yeah.
Same thing with, you know, the fatality rate on this virus. I've had people claim I'm wrong and no one can show me any math that contradicts the numbers that I'm putting out there. And it's shocking, but look, your voice is very important. Your work is very important. I want to encourage our readers to go to your website, jrnyquist.blog. And your articles are becoming very, very popular. And you're putting out, what, one or two a week right now? Is that the pace?
Yeah, I did. I'm trying to do two a week. But if I have to really document something, it's going to take me all week to do one.
Sure.
Okay. They're fairly long and substantial. I mean, my last one, I've developed a source just to, I know we have a little time left. I just wanted to get this in. I became interested in the fact that the leaders of Russia, China, Nicaragua, and Venezuela were in hiding. Nobody's seen Daniel Ortega in a while, and North Korea. You know, supposedly Kim Jong-un has had an operation, but it's been more than 2 weeks, almost 3 weeks since anyone's seen him. Same thing with Putin, and there's this funny business about the Russian government being fired in January, where they've retained some of these people, like they're putting them underground. I speculated about that in January. So I wanted to know, are all the communist countries, are their leaders in being put in bunkers? Now, you see, you don't need to go to a bunker to be safe from the virus.
That's right.
A bunker's a nuclear war thing. So I have sources for Cuba, because the countries I didn't have is Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, and Cuba. I wanted to know. I don't have any way to check on Mongolia. And my source for Southeast Asia came in. Indeed, 80% of the essential party and military staff are rotating at 2 and 3 week intervals out of bunkers. And they are told, by the way, that China and Russia are getting ready for a coordinated aggressive action against the United States, and that it might be leading to thunderous war, quote unquote, a real war, a kinetic war. Wow. And this is what's being told to the communist allies of Russia and China in Southeast Asia. So this confirms my theory that these leaders in Russia, China, North Korea, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, they just haven't disappeared. They're worried that if we catch on to what they're doing, we're going to come after their leaders and try to kill them in their places of residence. So it's very worrisome. It is very dangerous right now.
And there is a very real risk of global thermonuclear war.
Yes, absolutely. People don't understand. I'll just say this. Fusion bombs, tritium, they're not, we'll have all these Fukushimas. No, that's fission. Nuclear power plants are dangerous because they're fission. They produce a lot of nuclear pollution. Hydrogen bombs? Uh-uh. You could drop hydrogen bombs up and down the U.S. West Coast by airbursting, and you have no fallout. None. The troops could be coming in just hours later after the devastation and moving through and taking everything over. So, and besides, nuclear weapons, they're not going to use them against cities unless the cities buy a military target. Nuclear weapons are going to be used against military targets, immediate destroy now targets.
That's right.
Did you know that they did a study in 1980 in Australia, full-blown fusion bomb, hydrogen bomb war in the Northern Hemisphere, 60,000 nuclear bombs going off. You know what they determined that for Australia, the cancer rate in Australia, there'd be a few more leukemias and cancers from the hydrogen bomb fallout from the 60,000. But the cancer rate would go down because the imports of tobacco from the U.S. would be cut off. So, and we're talking a full-blown hydrogen bomb war with the maximum nuclear would produce less atmospheric radiation than the fission bomb testings of the 40s and the 50s.
Yes.
People don't know this. There's two kinds of radiation from nuclear detonations. Is the long-lived isotopic radiation from the bomb itself. It exploded, however. But if you ground burst a nuclear weapon of any kind, it vaporizes the solid objects within the fireball radius. And, you know, a hydrogen bomb fireball is 10 times hotter than the surface of the sun. And that heat, you know, like all heat rises like a hot air balloon, that giant ball with all of those vaporized solid objects goes up into the upper atmosphere. Now, what it does is it converts, it supercharges that matter with radioactivity called short-term fallout, which initially it's like 20,000 rads an hour it will put out. And that will then descend downwind in an elliptical pattern of hot radiation, which lasts 13 to 18 days. And anything that's above ground will be killed. You have to be underground. That's why you need a fallout shelter. Now, ground bursting is necessary to destroy bunkers. So if you're like going after Bremerton, Washington, the Boomer base there with its nuclear weapon storage or nuclear weapon storage facilities, missile silos, anything that's hardened, you're going to have these hot zones. But 13 to 18 days, that radiation's gone.
I see.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, we have a lot to talk about. Again, I hope you'll join me again, because I agree with you that the risk of nuclear war is very high right now, and the risk of financial warfare. China, for example, waging an assault on the dollar at the same time that they unleash cyber attacks on U.S. infrastructure, such as the power grid, for example, or any other key infrastructure, government infrastructure, and so on. I think these risks are very high right now, and America is quite vulnerable at the moment, and it doesn't look like this is going to end anytime soon. So I think your knowledge and your analysis is really crucial for us. I want to thank you for joining us today. It's always fascinating talking with you. Really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, absolutely. Folks, check out Jeff's website, jrnyquist.blog. Read his articles, share them, and share this video on brighteon.com. And there's a previous interview a couple weeks ago that we did together. That interview is also available on brighteon.com. Probably these interviews would be banned on YouTube, so it's a good thing we've built an alternative platform so we can speak freely about these issues. Jeff, thank you so much for joining me today. I look forward to talking with you again. Stay safe.
Thank you, Mike.
This has been a Pandemic.News video report. If you want to live, read Pandemic.News.